Underworld, Disc 8.
Chapter 7. How deep is time? How far down into the life of matter do we have to go before we understand what time is? The old science teacher, Bronzini, moved through the snow, slogging, dragging happily. Head down, his cigar box tucked under his arm, the scissors, the combs, the electric clipper to do the nape of Eddie's neck. We head out into space. We brave space, line up the launch window and blast off. We swing around the planet in a song. But time binds us to aging flesh. Not that he minded growing old, but as a point of argument, in theory only, he wondered what we'd learn by going deeper into structures beneath the standard model. Down under the quantum, a million billion times smaller than the old Greek atom. The snow came down. Enormous star-tip flakes, feathery wet on his lashes, stuck and gone. And he raised his head to see parked cars, humped and stunned, nothing moving in the streets, snow on the back of his hand. Touches flesh and disappears. He climbed the stairs to Eddie's apartment and rang the bell. No ding or buzz, no sawtooth whine. He knocked on the metal sheath that covered the door and heard Mercedes approach in her slappy shoes. She opened up, calling back to Eddie, "You'll never guess who is it?" Bronzini handed her the cigar box, Garcia Vega, fine cigars since 1882. He took off his check cap and gave it to her. He got out of the old belted greatcoat he'd bought cheap at Freight Liquidation, where you go for factory discounts, for irregular suits and dresses, cardigans hijacked by mistake. They thought they were getting cigarettes. He gave her the coat. He wiggled his hands to show no gloves. Then he bent to unbuckle his galoshes, stepping out of them half dizzy from the bending. "Eddie, look. He wears slippers under his boots. The man is undescribable." He embraced the woman and the coat, and then moved into the living room rubbing his hands like a man treading across a Persian rug toward a birch fire and a snifter of rare brandy. Eddie sat there smiling. The real Eddie Robles, who lived inside the imposter. Inside the haunted likeness, arthritic, emphysemic, with ulcerated veins in his legs, retired, more or less, from everything. "I woke up this morning and I knew it," Bronzini said.
"You knew it? Time for Eddie's haircut." "In a blizzard? You woke up but you didn't look out the window?"
"It's a gentle snowfall, old-fashioned. You should go walking."
"Walking," Eddie said. "You have any idea what you're saying? Sit down, you're making me nervous."
"I can't give you a haircut sitting down. Where are my tools of the trade?"
"I should give you. You're the one who needs his haircut. You should carry a violin, Albert."
"You don't want to play chess with me anymore. There's no one left in the world I can defeat in chess. Trounce. I can trounce the way I trounce you. So you have to submit to the barber's moves. It's a beautiful snowfall from out of the past. Incidentally, Mercedes, where is she? Your doorbell's not working." They sat drinking hot chocolate. What Albert wanted was a shot of hooch from an imported bottle. He imagined the warm, wincing sting of a trickle of scotch. Durable, that was the beauty of the thing. It hit you so it lasted. The chairman scotched rumors of a takeover. A wedge you stick behind a wheel to keep a vehicle from rolling. That's a scotch. So was a line drawn on the ground, as in hopscotch, he thought.
"Doorbell? Only the doorbell?" Mercedes said.
"The elevator, of course. But we know about the elevator."
"You know about the plaster?" she said. "I put newspapers in the cracks. Someday they find this place and they know exactly when the trouble started. From the newspapers."
Let the man live, Eddie said. Talk about something else.
My own elevator, this is a problem, Bronzini said. Periodic breakdowns.
Four flights?
Five flights. Let the man live, Eddie said.
Five flights with his heart?
Talk about something else.
Mercedes was heavy, disposed to gesture, swaying in the chair, hands sweeping, but ably taking care of feeble Eddie, the impostor, the aching and stiff-jointed and gasping man. The old Eddie of the subways was a robust guy, selling tokens from a booth in that cinema dimness of bad air and sprocketing trains, immune to the hell-rattle of the express. And she tended him now with expert love, with knowledge and command. And when she got mad at something, it made Albert want to hide, because he was a coward of blunt emotion. Things met head-on and direct.
They put up the barbed wire to save us from drug dealers. But what about the water when it rains? Comes right in.
I don't want to see winter end. I'd rather be cold. I'd rather jam newspapers in the cracks, because when the snow melts...
The man is happy. Let him live, Eddie said. She got a kitchen chair for Eddie to sit on. She got the cigar box and put it on the table and opened it. She went away and came back with a bath towel, which she placed over her husband's upper body and then spread down around his knees. She fastened the two upper corners at the back of his neck, loosely, and then she looked across at Albert, who shared her satisfaction with all the collateral matters, the stir of preparations crucial to the business of the haircut. Albert took the implements out of the cigar box. He set them on the table a couple of inches apart. The short black rubberized comb, tapered for sideburns. The tortoiseshell comb with a handle and three missing teeth, called a rake comb. The beautiful pair of scissors made in Italy, a family possession for generations, one of those things that turns up among the effects of the deceased, suddenly seen anew, an everyday treasure. Filigreed shanks, and a spur attached to one loop, a curved projection to support the middle finger. You put your index finger in the loop and rest the middle finger against the suitably shaped appendage. What else? The shaving brush. Not needed. The nose scissors. Let him do his own nose. The electric clipper, heavy and black, Elk Grove, Illinois. Blade still a little wispy with Eddie's shorn hair of 6 weeks ago. What else? Tube of lubricating oil for clipper. Five-and-dime whisk broom. Soft-bristled. He had no idea how to cut hair. He'd done Eddie's hair a number of times, but hadn't worked out a method. He paused often to study the effect, snipping, stepping back. Mercedes didn't stay around to watch. Working slowly, snipping. The idea was to get the hair off the guy's head and onto the floor. Mercedes didn't seem to think this was a thing she had to see.
They have a new thing, maybe you heard, Eddie said, called space burials.
I like it already.
They send your ashes into space.
Sign me up, Bronzini said.
They have orbits you can select. There's an orbit around the equator. This is one orbit. The Earth turns and you turn. Not you, your ashes.
Is there a waiting list?
There's a waiting list. I saw it on the news. Plus the premium shot. This is way out there.
Deep space.
Way out. You and the stars.
But you don't go up alone.
You go up with about 700 other ashes in the same shot. Humans and their pets. You call the company, they'll put you on the list.
What if you're already dead?
So your children call. Your lawyer calls. The important thing is, how much do your ashes weigh? Because this is costing you. Guess.
I can't guess.
Guess, Eddie said.
You have to tell me.
$10,000 a pound.
Eddie worked this line with a finality that had a grim pleasure in it.
A pound?
What do we weigh in ashes when we're dead? Albert said. I think it sounds reasonable myself. You think it sounds reasonable? Then you ruin my story. A pound of ashes, Eddie. That could be a whole family. For burial in space, preserved forever. You ruin my story, he said.
Albert used the rake comb, working the top of his friend's head. He combed in sweeping motions, letting the hair settle, then combing again. He loved this work. He used the scissors sparingly up here because a mistake might show. He moved the comb softly through Eddie's thinning hair. He lifted the hair, then let it fall. Mercedes played the radio in the kitchen, making dinner, or maybe lunch. Albert was vague lately on the subject of time. A heartbeat, a wrist pulse, a tapping foot. This was discernible time. He lifted the hair, then let it fall.
You missed the booth, Eddie? I liked my job.
I know you did.
All those years and never once.
They never robbed you.
Never even tried, he said.
That's the genius of New York. Eddie Robles, with a miniature chess set, practicing moves at 2 a.m. in his token booth, and don't think people didn't pop their faces in the slot and challenge him to a game. And don't think he didn't play them, because he did, behind 5 layers of bulletproof glass, with trains blowing by in the night.
I never thought today's the day they robbed me. I never had this thought, and it never happened. I had a woman vomit in the slot. My worst incident, personally. I never thought what I would do if they tried to rob me. I had the psychology, you plan for it, then it happens. She puts her hands on the ledge, and out it comes.
Middle of the night?
Just her and me. You have to vomit, why can't you do it on the tracks? Her and me, alone in the station, she comes right over like the coin slot they intended, just for this.
He plugged in the clipper and did the back of Eddie's neck. He went down under the towel and the shirt collar and did the hair that grew up from the shoulders. He cleared the neck completely and dusted with the brush and asked Mercedes for some talcum powder, which was the one thing he didn't have in the cigar box, and he made a mental note to resupply for next time.
Space burial.
He thought of the contrails on that blue day out over the ocean, 2 years ago, if that's when it was. How the boosters sailed apart and hung the terrible letter Y in the still air. The vapors stayed intact for some time, the astronauts fallen to sea, but also still up there, graved in frozen smoke. And he lay awake in the night and saw that deep Atlantic sky, and thought this death was soaring and clean, an exalted thing, a passing of the troubled body into vapor and flame, out above the world, monogrammed, the Y of dying young. He wasn't sure people wanted to see this, willing to see the system's failure and the human suffering, but the beauty, the high faith of space. How could such qualities be linked to death? 7 men and women, their beauty and ours, revealed in a failed mission, as we haven't seen it in 100 triumphs. Apotheosis. Yes, they were God-statured, transformed in those swanny streaks into the only sort of gods he cared to acknowledge, poetic and fleeting. He found this experience even more profound than the first moonwalk. That was stirring, but also a little walkie-talkie, with ghosted action, movements that looked computerized. And he could never completely dismiss the suspicions of the paranoid elite, the old grizzled Gurkhas of the Corps, that the whole thing had been staged on a ranch outside Las Vegas. In the spring, they were still there, Albert and Laura. How was it possible his sister had not fallen into some calamitous illness? You sit there. You let your body go weak and slack, You don't walk, you don't see people or mingle, or feel the blood flow of inquisitive interest. But he was grateful for her presence. There had always been a woman close to him. One woman, at least. A woman or a girl, sharing the bathroom, the kitchen, long ago the bed. He needed this company. Women and their pride of time, their vigorous sense of the future. He married a Jew and loved her. But Clara's future did not include him. He took care of his mother, a Catholic of the old eloquence, wearing a scapular, blessing herself and touching her thumb knuckle to her lips, and he loved her and watched her die. He raised his daughter to make her own fate, to be a worthy individual outside compliance with religious rites, and he loved her. She lives in Vermont now, very much. And his sister, drifting in and out of the past, but knowing him always in uncanny ways, seeing straight into his unadorned heart. And he loved her, for all the stammered reasons you love a sister, and because she'd narrowed her life to a few remarks that he found moving. He had a portable phonograph, sleek-seeming once, advanced design. Now looked drab and squat, but still played music after all these years. He found the record he was looking for and polished the vinyl with a treated cloth and placed it host-like on the spindle. Saint-Saëns. Piano works. Gentle and pensive. A change of pace from the gorgeous torment of Bronzini's operas. The tabloid sensation that shatters teacups. He turned to make sure Laura was here, shapeless in the armchair, head resting against the hand-knit antimacassar, face lifted to the chords. He clicked the dial and watched the tone arm rise and the record descend, a jerky downslide to the turntable. Then the tone arm shifted laterally, and the disc began to spin, and this series of laboriously linked actions with their noises and pauses and teeterings, their dimwit delays, seemed to place him in some lost mechanical age with the pendulum clock and hand-cranked motor car. The needle slurred some notes, but he was used to that. He sat at the edge of the room, where he could feel the kitchen sun and look at Laura's face. The music joined them edgewise. He believed he could enter her reverie. He could know her, almost know her, feel her innocence through the music, know the girl again, the spinsterly 12-year-old who walked behind her parents in the street. He could see her in the face of the somber older sister. She was almost there, the girl, in the pouches and moles and smoky hair. There was a brief moment in one of the pieces, after passage work of mellow recollection, when something dark seemed to enter, the soloist's left hand urging the tempo, and it made her raise an arm, slowly, a gesture of half-shock, thoughtful and fraught. She'd heard a boding in the bass notes that startled her. And this was the other thing they shared, the sadness and clarity of time. Time mourned in the music. How the sound, the shaped vibrations made by hammers striking wire strings, made them feel an odd sorrow, not for particular things, but for time itself. The material feel of a year or an age. The textures of unmeasured time that were lost to them now. And she turned away, looking past her lifted hand into some transparent thing he thought he could call her life.
"You have to tell me, Albert, when you're going out, so I know."
"I did tell you."
"You never tell me."
"I do tell you."
"I don't know if you forget, or what's the reason?"
"I will tell you. If you tell me, then I know. I will tell you. I will be sure to tell you."
"But I forget, don't I?"
"Sometimes, yes.
You tell me, and I forget."
"Sometimes. It's not important."
"But you have to tell me."
"I will. I will tell you."
"So this way, I know," she said.
He took his coffee black, with a stab of rye in the morning, a nip, a pin drop. And with anisette in the afternoon or early evening, a shot, a jolt of the licorice sap. And maybe a beady tongue taste of rye again before retiring, without coffee this time. Medically forbidden, of course, but just a driblet, a measured snort, the briefest swig in the history of guilty drinking.
You have to tell me so I know.
I will tell you, I promise.
This way I know.
This way you know.
If you tell me, then I know.
That's right.
That's right, isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
But you have to tell me. That's the only way I know.
He cleaned the kitchen windowsill. Dust, hair, flyheads, flakes of plaster, stony little spalls. When they made dinner together, she hit Albert's hand every time he got in the way, a jurisdictional tap on the back of the hand. He set his three pills next to his plate on the table, lined up for consumption, his heart pill, his fart pill, and his liver pill. He spent more time indoors when there were people in the halls. He'd seen a hypodermic syringe on the second-story landing, and now there were people in the halls, busy and inert at the same time. Busy inside their eyes, but also body dead, barely able to drag a hand through the air. When it stops raining, he thought, they'll go to the playground or empty lots. And the elevator was stuck between floors, so he was better off not leaving the apartment anyway, because it was not a good idea for him to be climbing stairs. He slipped her glasses off her face and cleaned them with a tissue and put them back. And when he went out, they were on the front stoop, muttering something that sounded like Wall Street. And Albert finally surmised this was a brand of heroin for sale. Wall Street, Wall Street. And he could hear them in the halls, strangers in the building, breathing in and out. He told her he was calling his daughter Teresa long distance. He announced every phone call to keep Laura involved, including weather and time, and because he liked to make announcements. His daughter ran a child care center in a small city and had expenses and two children of her own and a lapsed husband trying to start a new career, and Albert sent her a little money now and then out of his teacher's pension. A long-distance call was an act of pre-deliberation that filled a span in his mind much more extended than the length of the call. He planned an evening around it, waiting for the hour of the rate change, and then placing a chair by the telephone and working the numbers carefully, his face down in the rotary dial. He heard them breathing in the halls, and knew he had food for 2 days easy. And when the milk went sour, he could open a can of peaches and dump the fruit and syrupy juice on the breakfast cereal. Clingstone, flesh that clings to the pit, to the stone, as with a peach. He heard them late at night, and he knew he could stretch the chopped meat, bulk up the tomato soup with macaroni. And they didn't live in the building, and would find another place. When his daughter answered the phone, he looked across the room to Laura and nodded. Contact made. The century of progress marches on. Apples and cheese. They had apples and cheese. That was a meal in itself. He was taking a book back to the library. Another spring or early summer. A mild-hearted day. And he saw a familiar figure crossing the street and going toward the convent that was part of the Catholic grammar school. Anciently familiar, a figure from the land of the past. He hadn't realized she was still alive. Sister Edgar. How remarkable. The same blade face and bony hands, hurrying, a spare frame shaped by rustling garments. She wore the traditional habit, with long black veil and white wimple, and the starched cloth piece over the neck and shoulders, an iron crucifix swinging from her waist. She might have been a detail lifted from a painting by some 16th-century master. He watched her open the convent door and disappear.
This was a nun who'd been notorious for the terror she spread among the children, fifth graders or sixth graders. Beatings, vituperations, keep them after school, send them out to clap erasers in a rainstorm. He'd never exchanged a word with Sister Edgar, but felt half an urge to knock on the convent door and speak to her now. Find out who she was after all these years. He'd been proud to teach in a public school. Never mind the lax discipline. He worked among humane colleagues and heard stories about this nun and her routine cruelties. He walked with a cane now, and it gave him a feeling of Professor Emeritus. At the local library, named after Enrico Fermi, there was a photograph on the wall showing the scientist with an early model of the first atomic bomb. Years ago, Albert used to entertain the idea of certain affinities between himself and the great Fermi. Illness in early childhood, marriage to a Jewish woman, science itself, of course, cultural heritage, the allowable flush of Italian pride, only not so rousing in this case, attached to such destruction. The library was a movie house then, known to neighborhood kids as the Dumps for its sour odors and unswept debris. Let's not forget how some things get better, he thought. Books now, the hush of decimaled stacks. He walked to the social club, where he played cards sometimes, less than he used to, and took an occasional glass of wine. Some pictures on the wall, old days, fishmongers in aprons and caps, waiters outside a restaurant with sharply parted hair, dignified by time. He heard the church bell at Mount Carmel, half a block away, and poured himself a glass of red. He sat alone at a formica table and studied the legs of the wine, the trickles of swirled liquid that run down the inside of the glass and tell you how much body the wine has. This wine had legs. It was all legs. It had the legs of a sumo wrestler. The videotape was running on the TV set in the corner. He'd seen the tape only once before, right here, and knew that they would keep running it until everyone on the planet had seen it. And when they started running it again after an interval of not running it, he knew it meant the shooter had shot someone else, someone new. And because there was no film or tape of the new shooting, they had to show the old tape, the only tape, and they would show it to the ends of the earth. Steve came over. Silvera, one of the Silvera brothers. He wore a suit and drove a hearse. Albert always asked, "Who died?" "You drink that wine?" "I tried talking to it, but that didn't work," Albert said. "Sit down and join me. I got a funeral." "Who died?" "What's his name, from the fish market?" "Bury or cremate?"
"They put him on a wall nowadays. It's a popular thing."
"Encrypted," Albert said with satisfaction.
When the church bell rang again, Steve hurried out. Albert could lean a bit and see the other drivers and pallbearers put out their cigarettes and start up the steps. It was nearly time for them to carry out the coffin. Another fishmonger. One more photograph that will seem decades hence to be an emblem of a certain stately innocence, some old, lost, sweet-tasting time. How memory conspires with objects of human craft, pressing time flat, inciting a tender reminiscence. Later he went into the empty church and sat in the last row to spend a moment alone with Eddie Robles. A pigeon flew across the transept and landed on the edge of a swivel window near a bank of candles. He admired this old church, Corinthian columns and niched saints, lighted candles in rosy glass containers. The neighborhood changes, the church remains the same. In the days that followed Eddie's mass, he began to see again how the loss of a friend, how any loss was an aspect of Clara's departure, repeating the impact, the devastation. The pigeon was aloft again, fluttering up near the dome. He thought he recalled that the Holy Ghost took form as a dove, was it? Every ghost is holy, he supposed. But you'll have to point one out to me before I genuflect. Still, he liked to sit here alone, brood and mourn amid the architectural details, the faith of stone and wood, pigments mixed in glass. When Clara left him, it turned something loose. A rant. An unworded voice that incited feelings so varied and confused and bled together, so resistant to separation and scrutiny, that he felt helpless in its surge. It was a hindrance to living. It made him distrust the man he was supposed to be, soft-spoken, well-spoken, gently reflective. Oh, that bitch! And how unworthy of him to think of her that way. It was his sister, eventually, who kept him from despair. Another kind of voice, a woman marooned in introversion, only oddly loving. He needed to walk, shake his muscles loose, and he went out into the street. Yes, people talking, eating, the loyal shoppers, they came from other boroughs, other counties. The double-parked cars, the coronary throb of the immediate streets still palpable. He walked west across Arthur Avenue and then edged warily north, an old route lately forsworn, toward the high school where he'd taught for 30 years. Eddie dead, Mercedes in Puerto Rico now. Stop walking and you die. When he entered a street behind the high school, he was surprised to see it was closed to traffic. A play street, the pavement marked with painted game grids, with the numbered spaces of hopscotch and skelly, bases for slapball, and Albert was delighted. He'd thought this old custom of closing off streets for children's games was long dead, decades dead, a mind relic of life not yet dominated by cars and trucks. He stopped and watched the kids play, holding his cane across his waist as if gripping a stadium rail. Small children, slim and quick, Jamaican cadence in some of the voices, and a girl with mottled skin, maybe Malaysian or South Indian, he was only guessing, who jumped the hopscotch boxes with a measured deftness, doing a mid-air whirl so economical her hair was barely ruffled. Bronze skin that went darker and lighter, olive drab beneath the eyes. He wanted to stop her in mid-jump, stop everything for half a second. Atomic clocks, body clocks, the micro-world in which physicists search for time, and then run it backwards. Unjump the girl. Rewind the life. Give us all a chance to do it over. He recalled the word for do it over. A word that kids used to shout during a game, interrupted by a rare passing car or a lady crossing the street with a baby carriage. Indu, someone cried. Indu, or Hindu, he wasn't completely sure. The Indian girl in sneakers and jeans. Cheeky Cho's always goes. That's what the kids said when he got a second chance and did the same thing he'd done before the interruption. Hit a homer, kicked the can, shot a marble on target through the gutter dust. Cheeky Cho's always goes. He saw a vendor selling sugarcane from an open-sided van, mangoes in wooden crates and tall canes sheaved with twine. Some things get better, Albert thought. A library, a play street, prods to his optimism block by block. But what does do it over mean? He didn't want to lose his soul over compromises, second chances that turned him inside out. And anyway, we don't depend on time, finally. There is a balance, a kind of standoff between the time continuum and the human entity, our frail bundle of soma and psyche. We eventually succumb to time, it's true, but time depends on us. We carry it in our muscles and genes. Pass it on to the next set of time-factoring creatures, our brown-eyed daughters and jug-eared sons, or how would the world keep going? Never mind the time theorists, the cesium devices that measure the life and death of the smallest silvery trillionth of a second. He thought that we were the only crucial clocks, our minds and bodies, way stations for the distribution of time. Think about it, Einstein, my fellow Albert. He walked around to the front of the high school, tempted to go up on the portico and talk to the boys and girls standing there, but no, they didn't know him and didn't care. Then why come here? The old squat pile of limestone and brick held his teacherly corpus, a million words spun into tepid air. And there was no reason to think he'd need to pass this way again. One documentary look to freeze the scene. He made a circuit of the block and headed home. In one of the bare streets, he came across a large stray dog that looked diseased, all ribs and flecked slaver, and he sidled away from it. In a culture of guard dogs, there are always a few that fall from grace and end up haunting the streets. The trick is to skirt the animal without publishing your fear. Festina lenti. Make haste slowly. He cleaned the windowsills with a damp rag. Fly wings, fly parts, the crumpled husks of glassy green beetles. He had his teacher's pension and a small tax-deferred annuity and an old passbook with interest posted in cozy, broken type. Seasons ran together. The years were a stunned blur, like time in books. Time passes in books in the span of a sentence, many months and years. Write a word, leap a decade. Not so different out here, at his age, in the unmargined world. He put a record on the turntable, and Laura sat in the chair, seeming not to hear the music so much as see it. Bread was dependable. Bread with nearly every meal. Bread fresh from the brick ovens. He kept library books stacked by the bread box, so he would be sure to return them by the due date. Are we moving, Albert? No, we're not going anywhere. Someone told me. I don't remember. We're moving. Maybe we'll go see Teresa again. We'll take the bus. It's a beautiful ride. That's the only move we're making.
Did you tell me you were going out?
You like the ride, Vermont. We'll go when the leaves turn. You like it then.
Albert?
What?
If you tell me, then I know.
Seasons and years.
Laura read a soap opera digest to keep track of TV characters, even though the TV had gone on the blink so long ago, it was another life. Oatmeal bubbled on the stove. He came along and took her glasses off and cleaned them with a tissue, then placed them on her face again. Chapter 8. The old nun rose at dawn, feeling pain in every joint. She'd been rising at dawn since her days as a postulant, kneeling on hardwood floors to pray. First she raised the shade. That's creation out there. Little green apples and infectious disease. Then she knelt in the folds of the white nightgown, fabric endlessly laundered, beaten with swirled soap, left gristled and stiff. Sister Alma Edgar. And the body beneath, the spindly thing she carried through the world, chalk-pale mostly, and speckled hands with high veins, and cropped hair that was fine and flaxy gray, and her blue-steel eyes. Many a boy and girl of old saw those peepers in their dreams. She made the sign of the cross, murmuring the congruous words, Amen, an olden word, back to Greek and Hebrew. Verily, the most familiar of everyday prayers, yet carrying 3 years' indulgence,
7 if you dip your hand in holy water before you mark the body. Prayer is a practical strategy, the gaining of temporal advantage in the capital markets of sin and remission. She said a morning offering and got to her feet. At the sink, she scrubbed her hands repeatedly with coarse brown soap. How can the hands be clean if the soap is not? This question was insistent in her life. But if you clean the soap with bleach, what do you clean the bleach bottle with? If you use scouring powder on the bleach bottle, how do you clean the box of Ajax? Germs have personalities. Different objects harbor threats of various insidious types, and the questions turn inward forever. An hour later, she was in her veil and habit, sitting in the passenger seat of a black van that was headed south out of the school district and down past the monster concrete expressway into the lost streets, a squander of burnt-out buildings and unclaimed souls. Grace Fahey was at the wheel, a young nun in secular dress. All the nuns at the convent wore plain blouses and skirts except for Sister Edgar, who had permission from the mother house to fit herself out in the old things with the arcane names, the Wimple, the Cincture, and Gimp. She knew there were stories about her past, how she used to twirl the big beaded rosary and crack students across the mouth with the iron crucifix. Things were simpler then. Clothing was layered, life was not. But Edgar stopped hitting kids years ago, even before she grew too old to teach, when the neighborhood changed, and the faces of her students became darker. All the righteous fury went out of her soul. How could she strike a child who was not like her?
"The old jalop needs a tune-up," Gracie said. "Hear that noise? Ask Ishmael to take a look. Coo-coo, coo-coo. He's the expert. I can do it myself. I just need the right tools."
"I don't hear anything," Edgar said.
"Coo-coo, coo-coo. You don't hear that?"
"Maybe I'm going deaf."
"I'll go deaf before you do, sister."
"Look, another angel on the wall." The two women looked across a landscape of vacant lots, filled with years of stratified deposits, the age of house garbage, the age of construction debris and vandalized car bodies, the age of moldering mobster parts. Weeds and trees grew amid the dumped objects. There were dog packs, sightings of hawks and owls. City workers came periodically to excavate the site, and they stood warily by the great earth machines, the pumpkin-mudded backhoes and dozers, like infantrymen huddled near advancing tanks. But soon they left. They always left, with holes half dug, pieces of equipment discarded, styrofoam cups, pepperoni pizzas. The nuns looked across all this. There were networks of vermin, craters chalked with plumbing fixtures and sheetrock. There were hillocks of slashed tires, laced with thriving vine. Gunfire sang at sunset off the low walls of demolished buildings. The nuns sat in the van and looked. At the far end was a lone standing structure, a derelict tenement with an exposed wall where another building had once abutted. This wall was where Ismael Munoz and his crew of graffiti writers spray-painted a memorial angel every time a child died in the neighborhood. Angels in blue and pink covered roughly half the high slab. The child's name and age were printed under each angel, sometimes with cause of death or personal comments by the family. And as the van drew closer, Edgar could see entries for TB, AIDS, beatings, drive-by shootings, measles, asthma, abandonment at birth. Left in dumpster, forgot in car, left in glad bag, stormy night. This area was called the Wall, partly for the graffiti facade and partly the general sense of exclusion. It was a tuck of land adrift from the social order.
"I wish they'd stop already with the angels," Gracie said. "It's in totally bad taste. A 14th century church, that's where you go for angels.
This wall publicizes all the things we're working to change. Ismail should look for positive things to emphasize. The townhouses, the community gardens that people plant. Walk around the corner, you see ordinary people going to work, going to school, stores and churches.
Titanic Power Baptist Church.
What's the difference? It's a church. The area is full of churches. Decent working people. Ismail wants to do a wall. These are the people he should celebrate. Be positive.
Edgar laughed inside her skull. It was the drama of the angels that made her feel she belonged here. It was the terrible death these angels represented. It was the danger the writers faced to produce their graffiti. There were no fire escapes or windows on the memorial wall, and the writers had to rappel from the roof with belayed ropes or sway on makeshift scaffolds when they did an angel in the lower ranks. Ismail spoke of a companion wall for dead graffitists, flashing his wasted smile.
And he does pink for girls and blue for boys. That really sets my teeth on edge, Gracie said.
They stopped at the friary to pick up groceries they would distribute to the needy. The friary was an old brick building wedged between boarded tenements. Three monks in gray cloaks and rope belts worked in an anteroom, getting the day's shipment ready. Grace, Edgar, and Brother Mike carried the plastic bags out to the van. Mike was an ex-fireman with a Brillo beard and wispy ponytail. He looked like two different guys, front and back. When the nuns first appeared, he'd offered to serve as guide, a protecting presence, but Edgar firmly declined. She believed her habit and veil were safety enough. Beyond these South Bronx streets, people may look at her and think she's a quaintness of ages past. But inside the strew of rubble, she was a natural sight, she and the robed monks. What figures could be so timely? Costume for rats and plague. Edgar liked seeing the monks in the street. They visited the homebound, ran a shelter for the homeless. They collected food for the hungry. And they were men in a place where few men remained. Teenage boys in clusters, armed drug dealers, these were the men of the immediate streets. She didn't know where the others had gone, the fathers, living with second or third families, hidden in rooming houses, or sleeping under highways in refrigerator boxes, buried in the potter's field on Hart Island.
I'm counting plant species, Brother Mike said. I got a book I take out to the lots.
Gracie said,
You stay on the fringes, right?
They know me in the lots.
Who knows you? The dogs know you? There are rabid dogs, Mike.
I'm a Franciscan, okay? Birds light on my index finger.
Stay on the fringes, she told him.
There's a girl I keep seeing, maybe 12 years old, runs away when I try to talk to her. I get the feeling she's living in the ruins. Ask around.
Will do, Gracie said.
When the van was loaded, they drove back to the wall to do their business with Ismail and to pick up a few of his crew who would help them distribute the food. Ismail had teams of car spotters who ranged across the boroughs, concentrating on the bleak streets under bridges and viaducts. The nuns represented his North Bronx operation. They gave him lists that detailed the locations of abandoned cars along the Bronx River, a major dump site for stolen, joy-ridden, semi-stripped, gas-siphoned, and pariah dog vehicles. Ismail sent his crew to salvage the car bodies and whatever parts might still be intact. They used a small flatbed truck with an undependable winch and a motif of souls in hell graffiti on the cab, deck, and mud flaps. The car hulks came here to the lots for inspection and price setting by Ismail, and were then delivered to a scrap metal operation in remotest Brooklyn. Sometimes there were 40 or 50 cannibalized cars dumped in the lots. Museum quality, a junk world sculpture park. Cars bashed and bullet cratered, hoodless, doorless, and rust ulcered. Charred cars, upside down cars. Cars with dead bodies wrapped in shower curtains. Rats a scratch in the glove compartments. The money he paid the nuns for their locational work went to the friary for groceries. When the van approached the building, Edgar felt along her midsection for the latex gloves she kept tucked in her belt. Gracie parked the van, the only operating vehicle in human sight. She attached the vinyl-coated steel collar to the steering wheel and fitted the rod into the lock housing. At the same time, Edgar force-fitted the gloves onto her hands and felt the ambivalence, the conflict. Safe, yes, scientifically shielded from organic menace, but also sinfully complicit with some process she only half understood. The force in the world, the array of systems that displaces religious faith with paranoia. It was in the milky, slick feel of these synthetic gloves, fear and distrust and unreason. And she felt masculinized as well, condomed 10 times over. Safe, yes, and maybe a little confused. But latex was necessary here. Protection against the spurt of blood or pus and the viral entities hidden within. Sub-microscopic parasites in their Soviet socialist protein coats. The nuns got out of the van and approached the building. Squatters occupied a number of floors. Edgar didn't need to see them to know who they were. They were a society of indigents, subsisting without heat, lights, or water. They were nuclear families, with toys and pets. Junkies who roamed at night in dead men's Reeboks. She knew who they were through assimilation, through the ingestion of messages that riddled the streets. They were foragers and gatherers, can redeemers, the people who yawed through subway cars with paper cups, and doxies sunning on the roof in clement weather, and men with warrants outstanding for reckless endangerment and depraved indifference. And there were shouters of the spirit. She knew this for a fact, a band of charismatics who leapt and wept on the top floor, uttering words and non-words, treating knife wounds with prayer. Ismail had his headquarters on the third floor, and the nuns hustled up the stairs. Grace had a tendency to look back unnecessarily at the senior nun, who ached in her movable parts but kept pace well enough, her habit whispering through the stairwell. "Needles on the landing," Gracie warned. Watch the needles, sidestep the needles, such deft instruments of self-disregard. Gracie couldn't understand why an addict would not be sure to use a clean needle. This failure made her pop her cheeks in anger. But Edgar thought about the lure of critical risk, the little love bite of that dragonfly dagger. If you know you're worth nothing, only a gamble with death can gratify your vanity. Gracie knocked on the door. "Don't get too close to him," Edgar said.
"Who?"
"Ismail."
"Why?"
"He's not well."
"I saw him 3 days ago. I was here. You weren't, sister. How do you know he's not well?"
"I can sense it."
"He's well. He's fine," Gracie said.
"I've sensed it for some time."
"What do you sense?"
"AIDS," Edgar said. Gracie studied old Edgar. She looked at the latex gloves. She looked at the nun's face, emphatic of feature, eyes bird bright. She looked and thought and said nothing. One of the kids unlocked the door. Latch bolts, deadbolts, steel shafts. Ismail stood barefoot on dusty floorboards in a pair of old chinos rolled to his calves and a parrot-print shirt worn outside his pants, smoking a whopping cigar and resembling some carefree islander wading in happy surf.
"Sisters, what do you have for me?"
Edgar thought he was quite young, despite the seasoned air, maybe mid-30s, sparse beard, a sweet smile complicated by rotting teeth. Members of his crew sat around on scavenged sofas, improvised chairs, smoking and looking at comic books. Too young for one, too old for the other. She knew in her heart he had AIDS. Gracie handed over a list of cars they'd spotted in the last 2 days. Details of time and place, type of vehicle, condition of same.
He said, "You do nice work. My other people do like this. We run the world by now."
Edgar kept a distance, of course. She looked at the crew, 7 boys, 4 girls. Graffiti, illiteracy, petty theft. They spoke an unfinished English, soft and muffled, insufficiently suffixed, and she wanted to drum some hard G's into the ends of their gerunds.
"I don't pay you today, okay? I got some things I'm doing that I need the capital."
"What things?"
Gracie said. Retroviruses in the bloodstream. Acronyms in the air. Edgar knew what all the letters stood for.
Azidothymidine.
Human immunodeficiency virus. Acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
Komitet gazdarstvennoy bezopasnosti.
Yes, the KGB was part of the multiplying swarm, the cell blast of reality that has to be distilled and initialed in order to be seen.
"I'm making plans. I get some heat and electric in here, plus pirate cable for the Knicks."
Here on the wall, many people believed the government was spreading the virus. Our government. Edgar knew better. The KGB was behind this particular piece of disinformation. And the KGB was responsible for the disease itself, a product of germ warfare, making it, spreading it through networks of paid agents. She'd stopped talking about these things to Gracie, who rolled her eyes so far up into her head she looked like science fiction. Edgar looked out the window and saw someone moving among the poplars and ailanthus trees in the most overgrown part of the rubbled lots. A girl in a too-big jersey and striped pants, grubbing in the underbrush, maybe for something to eat or wear. Edgar watched her, a lanky kid who had a sort of feral intelligence, a sureness of gesture and step. She looked sleepless but alert. She looked unwashed but completely clean somehow, earth-clean and hungry and quick. There was something about her that mesmerized the nun, a charmed quality. A sense of something favored and sustaining. She gestured to Gracie. Just then the girl slipped through a maze of wrecked cars, and by the time Gracie reached the window, she was barely a flick of the eye, lost in the low ruins of an old firehouse.
"Who is this girl," Gracie said, "who's out there in the lots hiding from people?"
Ismail looked at his crew, and one of them piped up. An undersized boy in spray-painted jeans, dark-skinned and shirtless.
"Esmeralda. Nobody knows where her mother's at."
Gracie said,
"Can you find the girl and then tell Brother Mike?
This girl, she'd be real quick."
A murmur of assent.
"She'd be a running fool, this girl."
Heads bobbing above the comic books.
"Why did her mother go away?"
"She'd be an addict. They predictable."
All street, these kids. No home or school. Edgar wanted to get them in a room with a blackboard, and then buzz their heads with spelling and punctuation. She wanted to drill them in the lessons of the Baltimore Catechism. True or false, yes or no, fill in the blanks. Ismail said,
"Maybe the mother returns. She feels the worm of remorse. But the truth of the matter, there's kids that are better off without their mothers or fathers. Because their mothers or fathers are endangering their safety."
"Catch her and hold her," Gracie told the crew. "She's too young to be on her own. Brother Mike says she's 12.
12 is not so young, Ismail said. "One of my best writers. He does wild style. Age 11 or 12. Juano. I send him down on a rope to do the complicated letters."
Edgar knew about Ismail's early career as a graffiti master, a legend of spray paint. He was the infamous Moonman 157, nearly 20 years ago. And he told the nuns how he'd marked subway cars all over the city, his signature running on every line. And Edgar believed this was where he'd started having sex with men, in his teens, in the tunnels. She heard it in the spaces in his voice.
"When do we get our money?"
Gracie said.
Ismail stood there coughing, and Edgar moved back against the far wall. She knew she ought to be more sympathetic to the man, but she was not sentimental about fatal diseases. Dying was just an extended version of Ash Wednesday. She intended to meet her own end with senses intact, grasp it, know it. Finally, open herself to the mystery that others mistake for something freakish and unspeakable. People on the wall like to say, "When hell fills up, the dead will walk the streets." It was happening a little sooner than they thought.
"I'll have some money next time," Ismail said. "I make practically nothing on these cars. My margin, it's very minimum. I'm looking I might expand out of the country. Don't be surprised, my scrap ends up in North, you know, Korea."
Gracie joked about this, but it was not a thing Edgar could take lightly. She was a Cold War nun who'd once lined the walls of her room with Reynolds wrap as a safeguard against nuclear fallout. The furtive infiltration, deep and sleek. Not that she didn't think a war might be thrilling. She often conjured the flash, even now, with the USSR crumbled alphabetically, the massive letters toppled like Cyrillic statuary. They went down to the van, the nuns and five kids, and they set out to distribute the food, starting with the hardest cases in the projects, just outside the wall. They rode the elevators and went down the long passageways, unknown lives in every wallboard room. Sister Grace believed the proof of God's creativity eddied from the fact that you could not surmise the life, even remotely, of his humblest shut-in. They spoke to two blind women who lived together and shared a seeing eye dog. They saw a man with epilepsy. They saw children with oxygen tanks next to their beds. They saw a woman in a wheelchair who wore a Fuck New York t-shirt. Gracie said she would trade the groceries they gave her for heroin, the dirtiest street skag available. The crew looked on, angry. Gracie set her jaw. She narrowed her pale eyes and handed over the food. They argued about this, and it was Sister Grace against everybody. Even the wheelchair woman didn't think she should get the food. They talked to a man with cancer who tried to kiss the latexed hands of Sister Edgar. She backed rapidly toward the door. They saw five small children being minded by a 10-year-old, all of them bunched on a bed, and two infants in a crib nearby. They went single file down the passageways, a nun at front and rear, and Edgar thought of all the infants in limbo, unbaptized, babies in the semi-nether, and the non-babies of abortion, a cosmic cloud of slushed fetuses floating in the rings of Saturn, and babies born without immune systems, bubble children raised by computer, and babies born addicted. She saw them all the time. 3-pound newborns with crack habits, who resembled something out of peasant folklore. They handed out food, and Edgar rarely spoke. Gracie spoke. Gracie gave advice. Edgar was a presence only, a uniformed aura in regimental black and whites. They went down the passageways, three boys and two girls forming one body with the nuns, a single sway-backed figure with many moving parts. And they finished their deliveries in the basement of a tenement inside the wall, where people paid rent for plywood cubicles worse than prison holes. They saw a prostitute whose silicone breasts had leaked, ruptured, and finally exploded one day, sending a polymer whiplash across the face of the man on top of her. And she was unemployed now, living in a room the size of a playpen. They saw a man who'd cut his eyeball out of its socket because it contained a satanic symbol, a five-pointed star. And Edgar talked to this one. He'd popped the eyeball from his head and then severed the connecting tendons with a knife. And she talked to him in English and understood what he said, although he spoke a language, a dialect none of them had ever heard, finally flushing the eye down the communal toilet outside his cubbyhole. Gracie dropped the crew at their building just as a bus pulled up. "What's this? Do you believe it? A tour bus in carnival colors with a sign in the slot above the windshield reading, South Bronx Surreal. Gracie's breathing grew intense. About 30 Europeans with slung cameras stepped shyly onto the sidewalk in front of the boarded shops and closed factories, and they gazed across the street at the derelict tenement in the middle distance. Gracie went half berserk, sticking her head out the van and calling, "It's not surreal! It's real! It's real! Your bus is surreal! You're surreal!" A monk rode by on a rickety bike. The tourists watched him pedal up the street. They listened to Gracie shout at them. They saw a man come along with battery-run pinwheels he was selling, bright-colored vanes pinned to sticks, an elderly black fellow in a yellow skullcap. They saw the Ailanthus jungle and the smash heap of mortified cars, and they looked at the six-story slab of painted angels with streamers rippled above their cherub heads. Gracie shouting, "Brussels is surreal! Milan is surreal! This is real! The Bronx is real!" A tourist bought a pinwheel and got back in the bus. Gracie pulled away, muttering. In Europe, the nuns wear bonnets like cantilevered beach houses. "That's surreal," she said. A traffic jam developed not far from the wall. The two women sat and waited. They watched children walk home from school, eating coconut ices. Two tables on the sidewalk, free condoms at one, free needles at the other.
"Granted, he may be gay, but this doesn't mean he has AIDS."
Sister Edgar said nothing.
"All right, this area is an AIDS disaster, but Ismail's a smart man, safe, careful."
Sister Edgar looked out the window. A clamor rising all about them. Weary, beeping horns and police sirens and the great saurian roar of fire engine klaxons.
"Sister, I sometimes wonder why you put up with all this," Gracie said. "You've earned some peace and quiet. You could live upstate and do development work for the Order. How I would love to sit in the Rose Garden with a mystery novel and Old Pepper curled by my feet."
Old Pepper was the cat in the mother house upstate.
"You could take a picnic lunch to the pond."
Edgar had a mirthless inner grin that floated somewhere back near her palate. She did not yearn for life upstate. This was the truth of the world, right here. Her soul's own home. Herself. She saw herself, the fraidy child who must face the real terror of the streets to cure the linger of destruction inside her. Where else would she do her work but under the brave and crazy wall of Ismael Munoz? Then Gracie was out of the van. She was out of the seatbelt, out of the van, and running down the street. The door hung open. Edgar understood at once. She turned and saw the girl, Esmeralda, half a block ahead of Gracie, running for the wall. Gracie moved among the cars in her clunky shoes and frump skirt. She followed the girl around a corner where the tour bus sat dead in traffic. The tourists watched the running figures. Edgar could see their heads turn in unison, pinwheels spinning at the windows. All sounds gathered in the dimming sky. She thought she understood the tourists. You travel somewhere not for museums and sunsets, but for ruins, bombed-out terrain, for the moss-grown memory of torture and war. Emergency vehicles were massing about a block and a half away. She saw workers pry open subway gratings in billows of pale smoke, and she knew she ought to say a fast prayer, an act of hope, 3 years' indulgence, but she only watched and waited. Then heads and torsos began to emerge indistinctly, people coming into the air with jaws skewed open in frantic gasps. A short circuit, a subway fire. Through the rearview mirror, she spotted tourists getting off the bus and edging along the street, poised to take pictures. And the school kids going by, barely interested. They heard shootings all the time out their windows at night, death interchangeable on the street and TV. But what did she know? An old woman who ate fish still on Friday, beginning to feel useless here. Far less worthy than Sister Grace. Gracie was a soldier, a fighter for human worth. Edgar was basically a junior G-man, protecting a set of laws and prohibitions. She had a raven's heart, small and obdurate. She heard the yammer of police cars pulsing in stalled traffic and saw 100 subway riders come up out of the tunnels accompanied by workers in incandescent vests. And she watched the tourists snapping pictures and thought of the trip she'd made to Rome many years ago for study and spiritual renewal. And she'd swayed beneath the great domes and prowled the catacombs and church basements. And this is what she thought as the riders came up to the street. How she'd stood in the subterranean chapel in a Capuchin church and could not take her eyes off the skeletons stacked there, wondering about the monks whose flesh had once decorated these metatarsals and femurs and skulls, many skulls heaped in alcoves and hidey-holes. And she remembered thinking vindictively that these are the dead who will come out of the earth to lash and cudgel the living, to punish the sins of the living. Death, yes, triumphant. But does she really want to believe that still? After a while, Gracie edged into the driver's seat, unhappy and flushed.
Nearly caught her. We ran into the thickest part of the lots, and then I was distracted. Damn scared, actually, because bats, I couldn't believe it, actual bats, like the only flying mammals on Earth.
She made ironic wing motions with her fingers.
They came swirling out of a crater filled with red bag waste. Hospital waste. Laboratory waste.
I don't want to hear it.
Dead white mice by the hundreds with stiff, flat bodies. You could flip them like baseball cards.
Cars starting to move, Edgar said.
Ever wonder what happens to amputated limbs after the doctor saws them off? They end up in the wall, dumped in a vacant lot, or burned in the waste incinerator.
Drive the car.
And Esmeralda, somewhere in those shrubs and junked cars. I bet anything she's living in a car,
Gracie said. She'll be all right.
She won't be all right.
She can take care of herself.
Sooner or later,
Gracie said.
She's quick. She's blessed. She'll be all right.
Gracie looked at her, and drove, and looked again, hearing the engine knock, and said nothing. Edgar was never known to take an optimistic position. Maybe this worried her a little. And that night, under the first tier of scratchy sleep, Edgar saw the subway riders once again. Adult males, females of childbearing age, all rescued from the smoky tunnels, groping along catwalks and led up companion ladders to the street. Fathers and mothers, the lost parents found and gathered, shirt plucked and bodied up, guided to the surface by small, faceless figures with day-glow wings.
This ends Disc 8.